and firewood. He had an idea he'd be camping out here. Yes, there was a stream coming down from a nearby snow-capped peak, and there was plenty of firewood in the trees. He walked out and looked at the trench where the last battle had been fought against the Cyclopes. The grass was tall and waving in a lonesome-sounding wind. He climbed to the freighter cockpit, deeply troubled. 6. At evening, when he opened the cage, Turl sounded excited.
"Tell your horses and females goodbye, animal. Tomorrow at dawn, we're going on a long trip."
Johnny stopped with his arms full of the firewood he had been taking in.
"How long?" "5 days, a week, it depends," said Turl. "Why do you want to know?"
"I have to leave them food, a lot of things."
"Oh," said Turl indifferently. "Am I going to have to stand here and wait?"
He made up his own mind. He locked up the cage again and turned on the juice.
"I'll come back later,"
he rumbled off hurriedly.
"Well, here it goes," Johnny told himself. What devilry was going to take place now?
Fortunately, that day he had gotten a fat young bull. He swiftly went about his work. He quartered it and rolled up 2 quarters in the hide, putting it outside the door. "Chrissy," he called, "put me together enough smoked meat for a week. Also, think about what you'll need for that time."
"You're leaving?"
Was there a trace of panic in Chrissy's voice?
"Just for a little while."
Both girls looked apprehensive. They seemed so forlorn in there. Johnny cursed to himself.
"I'll be sure to come back," he said. "Get busy with the food."
He inspected Blodgett's wound. Blodgett could walk now, but torn muscles had ended her running days. The grazing problem for the horses was a little rough. He did not want to turn them loose, but he couldn't stake them to a week's grazing all in one spot. He finally settled it by letting them loose, but instructing Patty to call them to the barrier a couple of times a day to talk to them. Patty promised she would. He prepared a belt pouch with flint and tinder, cutting glass, and a few odds and ends. He folded up a complete suit of buckskins. He made a pack of these and 2 kill clubs. When Turl came back later in the evening and opened the cage door, Johnny rapidly moved in what Chrissy would need. She could smoke beef and work with hides. It would keep them busy. He took the packet she had prepared.
"You will be all right, Johnny?" she asked.
He didn't feel like smiling, but he smiled.
"I'll make it my first business in all cases," he said. "Now don't you worry. Put some of that tallow on Patty's neck and it will help the chafing." "Come on," said Turl irritably, outside the cage.
"How do you like the glass to cut things with?" said Johnny. Chrissy said,
"It is very good if you don't cut yourself."
"Well, be careful." "Hey," said Turl.
Johnny gave Patty a kiss on the cheek.
"Now you take good care of your sister, Patty."
He put his arms around Chrissy and hugged her. "Please don't worry."
"For crap, come on out of that cage," said Turl.
Chrissy's hand trailed down Johnny's arm. He drew away until only their fingers were touching.
"Be careful, Johnny."
Tears were rolling down her cheeks. Turl yanked him out and banged the cage door behind him. While Johnny closed the wood barrier, Turl turned on the juice.
"At dawn," said Turl, "I want you down at the landing field ready to go. Personnel freighter 91. Wear decent clothes and boots that won't stink the ship up. Bring your air pump and plenty of bottles and an extra mask. Is that understood, animal?"
He rumbled off, practically trotting. Turl was a busy fellow these days. The ground shake died out. Later, Johnny picked some wildflowers and berries in the dark and tried to throw them between the bars, but the electric current simply arced and sizzled them before they could get through. It made things seem even worse. He went to bed at last, dispirited, certain that the future was going to be very rough, if not fatal. 7. They were aloft at last, flying just to the east of north, rising rapidly to an altitude of over 10 miles. Turl loomed over the control panel, silent and withdrawn. Johnny sat at the co-pilot console, the seatbelt wrapped around him twice, air mask tending to mist. It was growing very cold in the flight cab. They were late getting off because Turl had personally gone over every fitting and unit of the plane, as though suspicious that someone might have sabotaged it. The actual ship number was 18 digits long, and only ended in 91. It was an old ship, a cast-off from some war on some other planet, and it showed its scars in dents and sears. It had a forward flight compartment like any freighter, but it was armored and fitted with batteries of air-to-air and air-to-ground blast guns. The huge body of the plane, now empty, was fitted to carry not ore, but 50 company attack troops. There were huge benches, bins for supplies, racks for their blast guns. There were many ports, all armored. The plane had not carried troops or even been flown for ages. Seeing that breathe gas compression would be off in the compartment, Johnny had thought it might be better to ride there, but Turl put him in the co-pilot seat. Now he was glad. This altitude probably had little air in it, and the cold was seeping into the cab with icy fingers. Below them, the mountains and plains spread out, apparently not moving at any great speed, even though the plane was well above hypersonic. Soon, Johnny knew he was looking at the top of the world. Pale green misty sea and white vastnesses of ice were all across the northern horizon. They were not going to cross the North Pole, but nearly. The chattering console computer was rolling itself out a tape of their successive positions. Johnny looked at it. They were turning in a curve to head more easterly. "Where are we going?" said Johnny. Turl didn't answer for some time. Then he yanked an intergalactic mining chart of the planet from a seat pocket and threw it at Johnny.
"You're looking at the world, animal. It's round."
Johnny unfolded the chart. "I know it's round. Where are we going?"
"Well, we're not going up there,"
said Turl, pointing a talon toward the north.
"That's all water in spite of its looking solid. Just ice. Don't never land there. You'd freeze to death."
Johnny had a chart open. Turl had drawn a red curving course line from the area of departure, up across a continent, then across a large island, and then down to the top of another island. Typical of a mining map, it was all in numbers and without names. He translated rapidly in his head back to Chinko geography. Using ancient names, the course lay up over Canada, across the top of Greenland, past Iceland, and down to the north tip of Scotland. On the mine map, Scotland was 89-72-13. After punching in a new series of coordinates, Turl put the ship on automatic and reached back of his seat for a container of Kerbango. He slurped some into his container cover and chewed it down.
"Animal," said Turl above the roar of the ship, "I am about to recruit 50 man-things."
"I thought we were almost gone."
"No, rat brain. There are some groups in various inaccessible places on the planet."
"And," said Johnny, "having gotten them, we are going to take them back to the defense base." Turl looked at him and nodded.
"And you're going to help."
"If I'm going to help, maybe we better talk over how we are going to do this." Turl shrugged.
"Simple. There's a village up in the mountains, where you see that red circle. This is a battle plane. We just dive in with stun blasts and then walk around and load the ones we want aboard."
Johnny looked at him. "No." Hostile, Turl said,
"You promised."
"I know what I promised. I'm saying no because your plan won't work."
"These guns can be set to stun. They don't have to be put on a kill setting."
"Maybe you better tell me what these men are going to do," said Johnny.
"Why, you're going to train them on machines. I thought you could figure that out yourself, rat brain." You've been ferrying the machines. So what's wrong with this plan?
They won't cooperate, said Johnny. With a frown, Turl studied that.
Leverage, leverage.
It was true that he wouldn't have leverage.
We'll tell them that if they don't cooperate, we'll shoot up their village for keeps.
Probably, said Johnny. He looked at Turl with disgust and laughed. It stung Turl. Johnny was sitting back now, looking at the map. Johnny saw that they were avoiding a mine site located in the southwest of England. He wagered with himself that Turl would come down to Wavetop in the last run into Scotland.
Why won't it work? Demanded Turl.
If I've got to train them, you better let me walk in and get them.
Turl barked a laugh.
Animal, if you walked into that village, they would drill you like a sieve. Suicide! What a rat brain!
If you want any help from me, said Johnny, offering the map, you'll land up here on this mountain and let me walk in the last 5 miles.
And then what will you do?
Johnny did not want to tell him.
I'll get you 50 men.
With a shake of his head, Turl said,
Too risky. I didn't spend over a year training you just to have to start all over.
Then he realized he might have said too much. He looked suspiciously at Johnny, thinking,
The animal must not consider itself valuable. Crap, said Turl. All right, animal. You can go ahead and get yourself killed. What's one animal more or less? Where's the mountain?
Well short of northern Scotland, Turl brought the personnel freighter down to Wavetop. They skimmed the gray-green water, eventually roared up the side of a cliff, shot inland, battering the scrub and trees, and came to a halt under the shoulder of a mountain. Johnny won his own bet. Turl had avoided the mine site in the south. 8. Johnny stepped down into a different land. The barren mountain and its scrub seemed to swim in a soft mist. Everything was hazed and faintly blue. It seemed a very beautiful place, but it had dark gorges and inaccessible summits, and there was a secretness about it, as though its softness concealed a harsh threat. He had not realized a land could be so different from the bold mountains of his home. He had changed to buckskin. He hung a kill club on his belt.
It's over there about 5 miles, said Turl, pointing south. Very rough terrain. Don't get any ideas about vanishing. There's a whole ocean and continent between you and your country. You'd never make it back.
He took out the control box and laid it on the seat behind him. He pointed at it. Could be, said Johnny, that by tomorrow morning I'll come back and get you to move into the village. So don't move off.
Tomorrow noon, said Turl, I'll come down and collect 50 men my way. If you're still alive, duck under something to avoid the stun guns, damned fool.
See you tomorrow morning, said Johnny, moving off.
Goodbye, rat brain, said Turl.
Johnny found a faint trail that went south, and alternately running and walking, wove his way through the gullies and brush and barren fields. It was not a very promising land for food. He did not start any deer, but he saw an old trace of one. There was not much grazing to be had. Far off on another mountain, he thought he saw some sheep, just a few of them, more like a small cloud than animals. He caught a glimpse of water through the scrub ahead and went up a gully, intending to get a better look. Yes, there was an inland body of water ahead. He trotted back to the trail. Abruptly, 3 pointed stakes jabbed out of cover. He stopped. Very, very slowly, he put up his hands, palms out to show they were empty of weapons. A guttural, wheezing voice said,
Take his club. Be swift now.
1 spear lowered, and a heavy-set youth with a black beard stepped forward, and a bit fearfully yanked the club from Johnny's belt. The youth retreated around behind him and pushed him. The other spears made way.
Look saucy now,
the wheezing voice said.
Dunna let him run away.
They came to a small clearing, and Johnny looked at them. There were four, two with black hair and dark eyes, a third with blonde hair and blue eyes, and taller than the rest, plus an old man who seemed to be in charge. Their dress was partly woven cloth and partly hides. They wore patterned skirts of some rough fabric that fell to their knees. On their heads they had bonnets.
"It's a thief from the Orkneys," said one.
"Nah, I ken Orkneymen," said another.
"Could be he's a Swede," said the blonde one. "But no Swede dresses so."
"Hush your prattle," said the old one.
"Look in his pouch, and mayhap you'll find the answer."
Johnny laughed. "I can give you the answer," he said. They recoiled on the defensive. Then a black-haired one crept forward and looked closely into his face.
"He's a Sassenach. Hear the accent."
The old man brushed the speaker aside with impatience.
"Nah, the Sassenachs be dead these many centuries, except for those already here."
"Let's go down to the village," said Johnny. "I'm a messenger."
"Ah," said the black-bearded one. "Clan Argyle. They want to talk of peace."
"No, no, no," said the old man. "He wears no such plaid."
He squared himself off in front of Johnny.
"Messenger ye be from whom?"
"You'll fall over on your backside," laughed Johnny, "when I tell you. So let's go down to the village. My message is for your parson or mayor."
"Ah, it's a parson we have. But you'll be meaning chief of the clan, Fergus. Get ahind him, you boys, and push him along."
9. The village sprawled on the shore of what they said was Loch Shin. It looked temporary, as though the inhabitants could easily pick up belongings and flee to a mountainside. A great many racks stood about with fish drying on them. A few children peeked, afraid, from behind fallen walls. No vast number of people came out to watch the group enter the village, but there was a feeling of eyes watching. Here, too, the mist softened the land. The waters of the loch lay placid and extensive in the quiet day. They put Johnny in the front chamber of the only whole stone house apparent. It had an inner room, and the old man went in. There was considerable murmuring of voices from in there as Johnny waited. A scrawny child peeked at him from behind a tattered cloth curtain, its blue eyes intense. He put out a hand toward it to beckon it closer, and it vanished in a flurry of curtain. There was evidently a back door, and Johnny heard it open and close several times. The murmuring in the inner room intensified. More people were coming into it from the back. At length, the old man came to Johnny.
"He'll see you now,"
he said, and pointed to the inner chamber. Johnny went in. About 8 men had assembled and taken seats along the walls. They had spears and clubs beside them or in their hands. Seated on a large chair against the back wall was a big black-haired, black-bearded power of a man. He had a short skirt that showed the bony knees of strong legs. He wore a pair of white cross belts, pinned together at the center of the X with a large silver badge. A bonnet sat squarely on his head, and he held a large ancient sword across his knees. Johnny knew he must be looking at Chief of the Clan Fergus. Fergus looked about at his council to see that they were all there and alert. He stared at the newcomer.
"A messenger," said Fergus.
"From whom?"
"Have you had any trouble with the monsters?" said Johnny. A shock went through the group.
"I take it you mean the demons," said Fergus.
"Would you mind telling me any trouble you have had?" said Johnny. This threw them into an uproar. Fergus held up an imperious hand. Quiet fell.
"Young man," said Fergus, "since you give us no name, as you claim to be a messenger, although you have not said from whom, though I suppose you will tell us in good time, I will do you the courtesy of answering your question."
Johnny was getting the notes of the accent and followed easily. The chief talked in his throat and clipped off the words.
"Since the days of the myths," said Fergus,
We have had nothing but trouble from the demons. The myths tell us they raised a cloud across the land and all peoples died except a very few. I'm sure you know these myths, since they are religious, and you appear to be a properly, politely religious man. All to the south of us, no man dare live. There is a fortress of the demons 500 miles to the south and west, and from time to time they foray out and hunt men. They kill them without reason or compunction. At this moment, you find us in the fishing village, for the fish are running. We sit here and work at risk. As soon as we have a little food, we will retire further into the highlands. We have always been a proud people, we of the Clan Fergus. But no one can fight the demons. Now that I have answered you, please continue.
I am here, said Johnny, to recruit 50 young, valiant men. They will be taught certain skills and will perform certain tasks. It will be dangerous. Many of them may die. But in the end, should God grant us fortune, and we are true to our task, we may defeat the demons and drive them from this world. It caused an explosion. The council had withdrawn into themselves at their chief's recitation of ancient history, and they had been made fearful. But the idea of someone combating the demons was so outrageous they exploded. Johnny sat quietly until the chief thumped the chair arm with his sword hilt. The chief looked at a council member.
You wished to speak, Angus?
Aye, that is another myth, that once long ago, when Scots were thousands, a great crusade went south, and they were crushed.
That was before the demons, shouted another council member.
Nobody has ever fought the demons, yelled another.
A grizzled council member stood forward, and the chief recognized him as Robert the Fox.
I do not deny, he said, that it would be a worthy cause. We starve in the highlands. There is little grazing for sheep. We dare not plough and plant crops as our ancestors once did in these rocky glens, for the myths tell us demons fly through the air and have eyes, and some say that the strange metal cylinder that passes overhead on some days is itself a demon. But I also tell you, he continued, that this stranger, clothed in what I take to be buckskin, signifying a hunter, speaking a strangely accented speech, smiling and courteous, and no Argyle, has voiced an idea that in all my long life I have never heard before. His words cause the mind to flare with sudden vision. That he can propose such a vision of daring and boldness proves that in some way he must be a Scot. I recommend we listen.
He sat down. Fergus was musing. We could not let all our young men go. Some would have to be from the Campbells, some from the Glen Cannons. But never mind. Stranger, you have not told us either your name or from whom you are a messenger. Johnny braced himself.
I am Johnny Goodboy Tyler. I am from America.
There was chatter. Then Robert the Fox said,
Legends say it was a land of the ancients where many Scots went.
Then he is a Scot, said another council member.
The chief held up his hand to quiet them.
That doesn't tell us from whom you are a messenger.
Johnny looked calm. He didn't feel calm. I am a messenger from mankind, before we become extinct forever. He saw a flicker of awe in some, a flicker of wonder in others. The chief leaned forward again.
But how did you get here?
I flew here. The chief and the others digested this. The chief frowned then.
In these times, only the demons can fly. How did you get here from America?
I own a demon, said Johnny. 10. He had to get Turl before the monster took off and blasted the village. The sun was arcing up perilously close to the deadline, noon. Johnny ran uphill on the trail, his heart overworked. Bushes whipped by. Stones rolled under his pounding feet. It had been a wild night and a hard-worked morning.
The clan chief had sent runners and riders thundering across the highlands to summon other chiefs. They came from far glens and hidden caves of the mountains, bearded, kilted, cautious, and suspicious, enemies, many of them, one to another. The chiefs of the MacDougalls, Glencannons, Campbells, and many others had come, even the chief of the Argyles. A subdued English lord from a group in the lower hills had come. The king of a tiny Norse colony on the east coast had strode in late. It was after midnight when Johnny could talk to them all. He leveled with them. He explained that Turl had personal plans of his own, independent of the company, and was using his power to further his own ambitions. He told them that Turl conceived himself to be using Johnny, and through Johnny, men to carry out his project, and that quite possibly Turl would slaughter the lot of them when he had finished with them. Johnny began to realize, as he spoke to the intent faces around the flickering council fire, that he must be dealing with some Scot love of guile. For when he told them that he had an outside chance of turning the tables and using Turl, only then did the chiefs begin to nod and smile and hope. But when he told them about Crissy, held as a hostage against his good behavior, and that part of his own plan was to rescue her, he had them. A streak of romanticism, which had survived all their defeats and humblings, welled up in them. While they could agree to a long-shot objective with their minds, they rose to the rescue of Crissy with their hearts. What does she look like? Black eyes and corn-silk hair. How was she formed? Beautiful and comely. How did she feel? Crushed with despair, hardly daring to hope for rescue. They were angered by the collar, disgusted with the leash, violent about the cage. They shook their chiefly weapons in the flashing firelight and made speeches and quoted legends. Beacon fires had been set flaming in the hills, their chiefs signaling a gathering of the clans. They sent their warlike messages until the dawn. A meadow was the assigned meeting place, and by noon the clans would be there. Questions and introductions and ceremony had detained Johnny until after 11 of the morning, and he looked up with a shock to see that he had very little time indeed to get to the plain and stop Turl from committing a folly that would ruin the future. With a sharp pain in his side from exertion, Johnny pounded up the steep, twisting trail, swift feet spurning the ground. He hardly dared to take time to check the sun. He could not be sure whether Turl was keeping the appointment by a clock or by the heavens. He dreaded any moment to hear ahead of him the roar of the plane taking off for a lethal pass over the village. More than 5 miles and all uphill, and over a very bad trail. Johnny heard the beginnings of a startup ahead of him. He was almost there. He burst through the brush at the edge of the plateau. The plane was already beginning to rise. He yelled, waving his arms, racing forward. If he missed, all his work would be undone. The plane hovered, feet off the ground, turning toward the village. Johnny threw his kill club the last 30 feet to strike the fuselage and attract attention. The plane settled back. Johnny collapsed on the ground, drawing air in loud, hoarse breaths. The roar of the plane turned off and Turl opened the door.
"Did they chase you out?" said Turl into his face mask. "Well, get in, animal, and we'll go down and carry out a proper plan."
"No," said Johnny as he crawled up into the seat, still panting. His feet were bruised from stones and he inspected them. "It's all set." Turl was derisive.
"All night I saw fires burning on the tops of the hills. I was sure they were roasting you for a feast."
"No," said Johnny. "They lit fires to call in candidates for the work group." Turl plainly did not see how this could be. "We have to be very careful," said Johnny. Turl could agree with that. "They're going to meet in a meadow about 3 miles from here."
"Ah, you got them to get together so we could blast them better."
"Look, Turl, we can succeed only if we do this exactly right."
"You sure are wheezing. Tell me the truth. Are they chasing you?"
Johnny threw down a moccasin and it made a loud snap. "Blast it, it's all arranged. Only we have to finish it. There will be hundreds in that meadow. I want you to land at the upper edge of it. I'll show you where. And then you must sit in the door of the plane and do absolutely nothing. Just sit there. I will choose from the candidates. We will get them aboard and leave by tomorrow morning.
You're giving me orders? Shouted Turl.
That's how it was arranged. He was putting his moccasins back on. You must just sit there in the plane door so you can watch and make sure it all goes well.
I understand, said Turl with a sudden grin. You have to have me there to frighten them into submission.
Exactly, said Johnny. Can we go down there now?
11.
There had never been so many together within memory, Robert the Fox said. Over 1,000 Scots, with a few English and some Norsemen, crowded the broad meadow. They had brought some food and drink. They had brought arms, just in case. And they had brought their pipers. The panorama was of colored kilts, ponies, shifting groups of men, and smoke from fires, and over all lay the skirling whine and shriek of bagpipes. There was a momentary surge back when the plane landed on the little knoll overlooking the meadow. But on Johnny's instructions, the chiefs had briefed their people well. And when the huge Turl took his position within the open plane door, there was no unseemly panic. The men left a wide distance between the plane and themselves, however. The obvious fear Turl saw on some of the faces confirmed for him that the animal had been right. He was needed there to overawe them. Johnny kept one eye on Turl. He could not be sure that Turl's sadism would not cause some sort of incident. Over 500 young men were part of the throng. Their chiefs had already talked to them, and they gathered now in a central group below Johnny. Johnny sat on a horse lent him by Chief Glencannon so he could be seen by all. He sat the mount easily, even though it had a saddle and bridle, things Johnny had never seen before, and that he considered a feat for one who never had trouble with horses. The chiefs and heads of groups stood with their young men. Outside these groups, and at the edge of the crowd, stood pipers. A few women, some young, some old, and older men, sat on the grass where a knoll side overlooked the scene. A few children raced about, running into legs. Johnny began. He already knew they had been briefed. His job was made much easier by a high literacy level among these people. They had not lost the art of reading and writing, and they knew a lot of history, mainly their own myths and legends. You all know why I am here. I want 50 young men who are able, courageous, and strong to go on a crusade to rid the world of the demon up there who does not speak or understand our language. When I ask you to look at him and shrink back in fear, please do so.
I am afeard of nothing, said one young man.
Just act so when I ask you to. I will not for a moment believe, and neither will your friends, that you are afraid, all right? The young man said it was. I feel it is necessary to tell you the character of this demon, so you can help me. He is treacherous, vicious, sadistic, and devious. He lies, from choice, even when the truth will serve. When I point now, cower back and look terrified. Johnny pointed. The crowd, on cue, looked up at Turl in the plane door and cowered back. Turl grinned behind his face mask. This was more like it. The mining company that conquered this planet in ages past has equipment and technology beyond those of man. Planes in the air, machines to drill the earth, gases and guns that can slaughter whole cities. Man has been deprived of his planet by these creatures. The men who volunteer to come with me will learn to use those tools, fly those planes, man those guns. Our chances are not in our favor. Many of us may die before this is through. Our race is growing fewer in numbers. In coming years, we may be gone forever. But even though the odds are against us, at least let it be said that we took this small last chance and tried. The crowd went into a raving, excited roar of enthusiasm. The pipes took it up and screamed. Drums pounded. Into the din, Johnny shouted, "I want 50 volunteers!" All volunteered instantly.
not just the 500 young men, but the whole 1,000 in the meadow. When he could again be heard above the shrilling pipes and shouting voices, Johnny announced a series of tests he would give during the afternoon. The chiefs turned to their people to organize it, and Johnny dropped down from the horse.
"Mon, McTyler,"
cried the grizzled old man who had first captured Johnny.
"Ye are a true Scot."
And Johnny found, as he assisted in straightening out the turmoil for the tests, that his name had indeed changed to MacTyler. There were even some arguments as to which clan his people had originally belonged to, but it was at length decided that the MacTylers had been distributed evenly among all the clans before they went to America. The only problem with the tests was in trying to disqualify someone. Johnny had the young men, one after another, walk a straight line with closed eyes to make sure their sense of balance was good. He made them run a distance to be certain their wind was excellent. He made them look at letters at a distance to make sure their sight was passing. Only a couple of the Norsemen were as tall as Johnny, but the scattering of black beards and blonde beards was about equal. Johnny assumed that refugees from Scandinavia or the Lower Countries and even from Ireland had changed their blood over the centuries, but it certainly had not changed the hardcore ethnology of the Highlands, which had held out now against all corners and defeats for thousands of years. The men got tired of just being examined. Some fights broke out from complaints of losers, and the chiefs organized competitions to settle things. The selections went well into darkness and were finally completed by firelight. But Johnny did not wind up with 50. He finished with 83. For diplomacy, Johnny requested the chiefs to select an older man as their representative, one in whom they felt confidence. They chose Robert the Fox as a veteran of many raids and very learned. So that made 51. Apparently, it would be unseemly not to have pipers, so two of those were chosen, and these claimed they needed a drummer, so one of those was selected. This made 54. Then some old women elbowed themselves to the front and demanded to know who was going to mend torn kilts, scrape hides, dry fish, care for wounded, and cook. And Johnny found himself with new arguments and elections, and five old widows of indeterminate age but universally attested skills. This made 59. Since the chiefs had been told there was a lot of study involved, Johnny found himself confronting a small but determined schoolmaster who claimed it took an iron rod to make young men who had appetites only for hunting and women study. And the chiefs said he must go too. Number 60. But the question of death had stirred up a row from three parsons. Who would care for the souls of these young men, and also keep them respectful? There was a further quarrel as to which of the three it would be, and the lucky one drew the long straw. This made 61. Johnny had his own plan to take care of. All of those chosen were bright, but he had to have three very bright ones who also came somewhere near his height and build, who could learn cyclo quickly, and who could, at a distance or over poor radio connections, look and sound vaguely like him. He found about a dozen and asked the chiefs, schoolmaster, and parson which of these were quick studies. They named three, and that made 64. A scholarly old fellow showed up who lamented the fact that no one would be writing the history that would become legend. It turned out he was the dean of literature of a sort of underground university that had been eking along for centuries, and on the argument that he had two capable replacements for himself in the school, and, due to his age and poor health, was expendable anyway, he could not be left behind by the MacTyler. Robert the Fox thought that very necessary, so that made 65. 18 outright, uncontestable ties had shown up in the contests the chief had arranged, and when it looked like blood would be spilled over it, Johnny gave in, and that made 83. He woke up Turl, who had been hitting the Kerbango pretty heavily since sunset and was lying like a mountain across the plane seats. "We have 83, said Johnny.
The plane takes 50 cyclos, and 83 humans won't occupy that space or make up that weight. I want to make sure you do not object to 83. Turl was foggy and sleepy.
The casualty rate of such a project is high. We have to make it appear that they are just training all winter when they are operating, so the extra numbers are fine. Why'd you wake me up for a silly question like that, animal?
And he went back to sleep. Johnny had culled another piece of Turl's project from this. Up to now, he hadn't any real hard data on Turl's plans. Praise all for Kerbango, thought Johnny as he went off. He had the historian draw up a roster of the Anguses and Duncans and all their parade of names, and sent them off in the night to hasten pell-mell to their homes and get heavy and light clothing and sleeping blankets, personal gear, and a few days' worth of food to tide them over until he could round up cattle. They must be back at dawn, and those who didn't have them borrowed horses, for in some cases it was a long ride both ways. Johnny had a final meeting with the chiefs. We have caused quite a row up here in the highlands, and although the local mine site is 500 miles away, it would be a good thing now for your people to be quiet and undemonstrative for the coming year. The English lord thought that was a very good idea. The chiefs agreed to it. There is a distinct possibility, said Johnny, that we will fail, and that I will never see you again, and the group will be killed. They brushed this off. Brave men always risk death, didn't they? And they'd not blame McTyler. The bad thing would be not to try. That would be what couldn't be forgiven. In the midnight chill, Johnny talked to those who had not been chosen, thinking he would leave disappointment there. But he found the chiefs had already told them that when the mission succeeded, they would be a recovery corps in charge of policing and reorganizing England, Scandinavia, Russia, Africa, and China, and they were already scheduling study, training, and organizing to do that at the end of a year. And the non-chosens were wild with enthusiasm. Fergus was spokesman as he calmly outlined it to Johnny. It worked on a clan system, of course. My God, gaped Johnny. These Scots thought big.
Don't fret, McTyler. We're behind ye.
Johnny, exhausted, stretched out under the fuselage of the freighter, wrapped in a woolen blanket hand-woven in the tartan of Clan Fergus, and fell into a hopeful sleep. For the first time since the death of his father, he did not feel alone. Chapter 7 1 The first trouble came from Turl. He had a hangover after his solo binge, and he had been irritated close to anger at the comings and goings and delays. At first light, Johnny began to load them as they arrived singly and in groups from their errands to their homes. The people in the meadow had not left, but had slept on the ground around fires. No one was going to miss the departure. More Scots, having missed the gathering of the clans due to distance or infirmity, had come in, and the number had doubled. Johnny began showing them how to tie down their gear in the military supply locks of the personnel freighter, and how to fasten themselves into the seats, two to a seat, and adjust the belts. He had gotten about six, fully settled, when two of them promptly got out of their seats again and started showing newcomers where to stow their gear and how to handle the belts. Some apologized for seeming to bring so little, but times had been hard, they said. It was no longer safe to raid in the lowlands. Some thought perhaps they were bringing too much, but one never knew, did one? Some were a bit late and streamed in a breathless rush, the historian worriedly checking off their names. The old women came in a clatter of kettles. The parson arrived rolling a keg, in case someone became ill. Johnny strapped it down tightly, curious. He had never seen whiskey before. The sun was getting higher. Turl roared from the cab,
"Get these filthy animals loaded."
People became very quiet. Johnny winked at them, and they relaxed and got loading going once more. Finally, they were all there, all 83 of them. Johnny said,
This flight will take several hours. We will go very high. It will be very cold and the air will be thin. Endure it somehow. If you feel lightheaded, it will be from lack of air, so make an effort to breathe more often. Keep yourselves tightly strapped in. This plane can turn in all directions and even upside down. I'm now going to the forward cab to help fly this thing. Remember that one day soon many of you will also be able to fly machines, so observe things closely. Robert the Fox is in charge here. Questions? There wasn't one. He had made them more confident in their new environment. They seemed cheerful, not afraid.
Take it up, McTyler, said Robert the Fox.
Johnny waved at the crowd out of the side door and they roared back. He slammed and locked the door. He settled himself in the co-pilot seat, wound the security belt around himself twice, put on his air mask and got out the map. Turl was looking sourly at the crowd. With vicious sudden gestures, Turl recompressed the cab with breathe gas and ripped off his mask, and Johnny saw his amber eyes were shot with green. Turl had been going heavy on the Kerbango. There was an evil twist to his mouth bones. He was rumbling something about late, and having no leverage on these blasted animals, and teach a lesson. Johnny stiffened in alarm. The plane vaulted skyward at a speed enough to crush him into his seat. It was at 3,000 feet in the wink of an eye. Johnny's map and hands were pressed painfully downward into the co-pilot control panel. Turl's talons snapped at some more buttons. The ship started over on its side.
What are you doing? Shouted Johnny.
I'm going to set an example, roared Turl. We've got to show them what will happen if they disobey.
The thick mob in the meadow was a small dot below them as the plane turned downward. Suddenly, Johnny knew that Turl was going to blast them. The ground came screaming up, the crowd getting large.
No! Screamed Johnny.
Turl's talons were reaching out for the fire buttons. Johnny heaved the map. Open, it pinned itself against Turl's face, cutting off his vision. The ground was coming up with speed. Johnny hit his own controls with staccato fingers. 200 feet up, the plane abruptly changed course to level. Its inertia sucked it down to only yards above the crowd's heads. Like a javelin, it shot forward. Ahead of them, the trees leaping larger, was the mountainside. Johnny's fingers stabbed keys. Branches hit the underbody. The plane rocketed up the mountainside only feet from the ground. It shot into the clear as they passed the mountain crest. Johnny leveled it and stabbed it at the distant beaches. He reversed the tape that had taken them on the incoming voyage and fed it into the autopilot. The sea sped by only yards below them. They were in the clear, undetectable by any mine-site observation post, heading for home. Johnny, bathed in sweat, sat back. He looked at Turl. The monster had gotten the map off his face. Flames were flickering in his green-shot eyes.
You almost killed us, said Turl.
You would have spoiled everything, said Johnny.
I've got no leverage on these animals, snapped Turl.
He looked over his shoulder to beyond the cab rear wall.
How, he added with nasty sarcasm, do you intend to keep them obedient? With little baby toys?
They've been obedient enough so far, haven't they? Said Johnny.
You ruined this whole trip for me, said Turl.
He relapsed into moody silence. At length, he rubbed at his aching head and fumbled around for his Kerbango. He brought up an empty container and threw it down. Johnny clipped it into a rack so it wouldn't go adrift. Turl found another one under the seat. He chewed off a slug of it and sat there gloomily.
Why, asked Turl at length, were they cheering yesterday?
I told them the end of the project would see them highly paid, said Johnny.
Turl thought that over. Then,
they were cheering because of pay?
More or less, said Johnny.
Turl was suspicious.
You didn't promise any gold, did you?
No. They don't know anything about gold.
Their currency is horses and such things.
High pay, eh?
Said Turl. He was suddenly very jovial. The Kerbango was taking effect. He had just had a wonderful thought. High pay. He knew exactly the pay they would get. Exactly. At the muzzle end of a blast gun. He cheered up enormously.
You fly this thing pretty good, rat brain, when you're not trying to kill everybody.
This struck Turl as very, very funny, and he laughed from time to time all the way home. But that was not what pleased him. How stupid these animals were. High pay indeed. No wonder they'd lost the planet. He had his leverage. He'd never heard such enthusiasm. 2. 48 hours after their arrival at the defense base, Johnny was very glad he had Robert the Fox along. He had to handle a threatened war. Two of the young men, amid all the flurry of settling in, had yet found time to discover the remains of a weapons cargo. A truck, in the last days of man's civilization, had apparently run into a road cut bank, and a cave-in had covered it. There it had remained for more than 1,000 years until Scott Hands uncovered it. Johnny had just come into the base with a group driving wild cattle before them. He had been very busy settling the group in. He had lots of help. No one required much in the way of orders. They had swept out and apportioned off an old dormitory. They had dug latrines. The parson had made the chapel useful. And the old women had found a place that could be protected from deer and cattle, and, being near the water, was ideal for a vegetable garden. Johnny had used a drilling machine to plow it up, and the women assured him that now nobody would get scurvy. They had brought seeds, and radishes and lettuce and spring onions would be up in no time in this sunlight and deep soil. The schoolmaster had appropriated the ancient academic building and had a schoolroom set up. The Scots had proven remarkably ingenious with machinery. They seemed to know what some of these pipes and wires were all about, having heard of them and read of them in their books. Thus, Johnny was not too startled to find a youth, Angus McTavish, holding out an ancient piece of metal to him and requesting permission to make this and the rest of the lot serviceable. Johnny had not thought that among all this bustle anyone would have time to dig up an old wrecked man truck and its contents. What is this thing? Said Johnny. The youth showed him some stamped letters. The object was covered with what must have been a very thick grease that, down the ages, had become rock hard, but had preserved the object. The letters, which the youth had cleaned off, said, Thompson Submachine Gun. It had a company name and serial number.
There's case on case of them, said Angus. A whole truckload, and airtight boxes of ammunition. When the grease comes off these, they might be fired. The truck must have run off the road and gotten buried in the cave-in. May I clean it up and test it, McTyler?
Johnny absently nodded and went on with the cattle. He was thinking about getting over to the base and getting a horse. There were plenty of wild horses, but they needed to be broken, and driving in cattle for food on foot was not the safest occupation he knew of. He was also speculating about using one of these small cyclo trucks to do the job. Food shortage had been a problem for the Scots, and there was no reason they could not be very well fed. It would make them even tougher and more able to stand the work ahead. He was not prepared for the deputation that came to him as he finished supper. A mess hall had been set up, and although the women were cooking outside, eating was being done inside, off broken tables with much eroded cutlery. Robert the Fox was sitting there with him. Angus McTavish held out the weapon to him.
It works. We cleaned it and figured out how to load and operate it, and the ammunition will fire.
Johnny could see that others in the mess hall were giving them their silent attention.
There's lots of these, and lots of ammunition, said Angus McTavish. If you climb the hill and look over to the east, off in the distance, you can see the cyclo mine site.
He smiled. A group could sneak over tonight and blow them to pieces. There was an instant cheer from the rest. Young men from other tables stood up and crowded around. Johnny had a horrible vision of slaughtered Scots and blasted plans. Robert the Fox caught Johnny's eye. He seemed to want a nod, and Johnny gave him one. He stood up. The old veteran was one of the few Scots who had ever seen a cyclo up close before the freighter had arrived. Raiding for cattle down into the lowlands where cattle now wandered amid ruins, Robert the Fox had once encountered a party of cyclo hunters from the mine site in Cornwall. The cyclos had wiped out the other members of the party, but Robert, clinging to the belly of a horse, had been able to flee the carnage unobserved. He was well aware of the power of the cyclo weaponry and the murderous character they exercised. "This young man," said Robert the Fox, pointing to Angus MacTavish, who was standing there holding his man-machine gun, "has done very well. It is a credit to be resourceful and brave." The young man beamed. "But," continued Robert the Fox, "it is one of the great wisdoms that one best succeeds at what one prepares totally. One mine site destroyed will not end the power of the cyclos. Our war is against the entire cyclo empire, and for this we must work hard and prepare." He became conspiratorial. "We must not wipe out just one base and alert them to our intent." That did it. The young men thought this was very wise and happily finished their dinner of roasts and steaks. "Thank you," said Johnny to Robert the Fox. The precipitate war was averted for the moment. A bit later, in the lingering twilight, Johnny took the older men down to show them the trench. He had begun to realize he had a sort of council. It consisted of Robert the Fox, the parson, the schoolmaster, and the historian. Johnny probed about in the grass, looking for iron bits, and at last he uncovered the almost totally eroded frame of a weapon that might have been similar to the Thompson. It was very hard to tell what make it was, but it had been a gun. Johnny told his council the history of the spot according to cyclo records. They hardly needed to get the point. Such weapons had not stopped the cyclos. But the historian, Dr. MacDermot, looked about curiously. "But where are the remains of the tank?" "It defeated them," said Johnny.
"No, that is very odd," said the historian. "Not that they were defeated here, but that there's no rusting remains of any cyclo battle equipment."
"This was a defeat," said Johnny. "The cyclos may have suffered damage, maybe not. But they would have taken any damaged equipment from the field."
"No, no, no," said the historian.
And he told them about a handwritten romance in the university library about a similar battle. It had occurred on a line between two ancient villages known as Dumbarton and Falkirk, at the narrowest point above where England and Scotland had once met, just below the Highlands.
"And the remains of cyclo tanks can be detected there to this very day?"
"That's true," said Robert the Fox. "I have seen them."
The historian said,
"No cyclo has ever come north of that point, not until you, MacTyler, flew in your demon. It is the only reason we can still exist in the Highlands."
"Tell me more of this romance," said Johnny.
"Oh, it is quite badly written," said the historian. "A curiosity, not literature. It was scribbled by a private in the Queen's own Highlanders who escaped north from the battle. A sapper, I think he was. They handle landmines."
"Landmines," said the parson. "Mines for ore?"
"No, no," said the historian. "I think they use the word mine for explosives buried in the earth. When the enemy crossed them, they exploded. The private used the term tactical nuclear weapons. He goes on about how a fragment of a regiment that had been in bunkers escaped the gassing and withdrew north. The captain, I think, had a girl in the Highlands. And they laid a string of mines from Dumbarton to Falkirk. Cyclo tanks in pursuit hit them and these mines exploded. The cyclos were not out of tanks or troops. They simply withdrew south, and they never came back to recover their dead or their equipment. The romance says it was due to the spirit of Drake intervening,
for drums could be heard.
Wait, said Johnny. Those were nuclear weapons.
Whatever those are, said the parson.
Uranium, said Johnny. There must still be